I'm Sonia. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, welcome to the Valley Group speaker meeting, and especially welcome to the newcomers. We're really happy to have you here, and we hope you guys keep coming back. Tonight we have a special treat. We have Chris W. from Ventura with 13 years of sobriety. He's got a really good pitch. I've been hearing about it, and I'm really excited. I didn't really get a chance to interview him as long as I usually do with other people, but I did ask him a few questions. So, of course, I asked him what his secret to sobriety is, and he immediately said the first sentence of Chapter 7. And then I drew a blank and looked at him and was like, please elaborate. And he said, nothing will ensure immunity from drink like intensive work with other alcoholics.
Amen.
He says that he got sober through H&I, which is our hospitals and institutions program. He was introduced to the 12-step programs as a teenager, and he says, I knew where I needed to go when I was at the end of my rope. Pretty cool that he had those resources. And for the advice for the newcomer, he says, get a commitment and help others. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speaker for the evening, Chris W., 13 years of sobriety. Thank you so much for letting me be of service. Welcome, Chris.
My name is Chris Wachnick, alcoholic. Thank you, Bill, for asking me to be here, and thank you, Sonia, for the nice introduction, and to the friends that I have here tonight. I want to say thank you. There you are. I know that Josh has been running around running his mouth, so let's all lower our expectations right now. Not of Josh, of me. I like to get to, you know, when I go to meetings, I like to get there a little early. Whenever I get asked to you know, have a commitment, I like to be there early. And tonight, as I was leaving Fresno, there was a big car accident, and I was stuck for, like, I don't know, 15 minutes. And the way that my mind works, I was on the phone with my sponsor who's had heart trouble. There's an accident a half a block in front of me, and I'm thinking about me. I was thinking about, I'm God's messenger tonight. That's where my brain goes, left unchecked. And it's a privilege for me to get to be here with you guys tonight. And it's important that I say that I get to be here by grace. You know, our program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of hope. And what I found here is that I have hope. When I came here, I got a little taste of hope. And what I've learned is that I'm here only by the grace of God. And I'm going to say that. I'm going to talk about God a little bit. And I, you know, if that offends you, tough shit. I'm a visitor up here. I've been up here for some work stuff for the last month. And I've been staying with my really good friend Karen, and she's opened her home to me, and I appreciate it. Thank you so much. It might be God. I get to be here by God's grace. And that's what I was going to say, is that I was a little, so I try to figure out, like, you know, when you go somewhere different and you're at meetings, and some communities, like, you don't you don't cuss at meetings. And then at other communities, like, it's just let it rip. And so I've been kind of like trying to feel it out around here. And there's some meetings that I go to, and I swear I was at like a revival. There's like, and it's God. And then at other meetings, it's like F-bombs up and down ones. And I'm thinking, man, dude, what is, do I, and I'm just going to be myself, and I hope that that's okay. God's grace and everything that I have to say, I've heard from you guys. So, you know, if you hear something that comes out of my mouth and you think, man, this dude stole that from, so I did steal it from someone. I stole it from you guys. And it's you guys that have, that God has worked through and through the first 164 pages of this book to save my life. And I believe that with all my heart. I know it through experience. So I'll do my best to share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope. So I was born in Northern California. I grew up in a community way up north called Redding, and I lived up there until I was 14, and I have a younger sister, and I grew up in a two-parent home, and it was a, you know, regular home, I think, at the time in the 70s and the 80s, you know, it was normal stuff. We had chores to do and homework to get done before the TV came on, and we weren't allowed to watch cartoons in the morning on school weeks, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and my dad worked for the federal government. And early on, I remember feeling different than my sister, feeling different than my dad, feeling different than my mom. And I should add, too, that I didn't grow up Catholic, but I went to Catholic school. And we went to a regular Protestant church on Sundays, so I was screwed all the way around. Super confusing. It's rough, you know, to sit on the pew during Wednesday Mass, and you're like the odd man out. And I already felt like the odd man out in life. And so we weren't like a super religious home, but it was church on Sundays. And if you didn't go to church, you're not living in this house. And that's just how it is. And so I just, okay, you know, I was a little kid, and so we went to church on Sundays, and that's was my concept of spirituality and of God. I started pretty early to kind of feel, I didn't know it then, but now I can look back, and I started to build a resentment against my dad. It seemed like nothing that I really did. How long do I speak for?
30 more minutes.
Okay. So, whatever that was, 30, 90. So
7:55.
Perfect. Thank you. So I started to build a little resentment towards my dad, and I just remember hearing him say, you know, why don't you work a little harder? You know, if you put half as much energy into your schoolwork as you do to go into the bathroom, you'd get straight A's. What the hell's wrong with you? And I just remember that sense coming in like, man, something's wrong with me. Something's wrong with me. And it's, you know, my dad was doing the best that he could with the tools that he had. And my life and the decisions that I made are not on him. But it's on me. But early on, I started to build this resentment towards him. I wasn't good enough. I didn't fit in. And it wasn't long before I just started thinking, you know what? Screw you, man. I don't need you. I don't like you. I'm not going to listen to you. I'm going to do what I want to do. And all this was happening as I was an adolescent, coming into my teenage years, and I desperately wanted to fit in. I wanted to belong somewhere. And so I played sports, and I was in junior high school politics, and I had a girlfriend, you know, every couple quarters that would switch around, and you know, whatever I could do to try to fit in and be a part of. And later that would change for me in my life. But what I found out was that I could get like a real quick burn, like when you're hungry and you eat a Snickers, you know, it lasts for about 20 minutes. So I could get a quick laugh in class. I could blow a spit wad or make a, you know, an animal noise, joke around like kids do, and I got a laugh. And I started to feel like, oh man, you know, they like me. They like me. So I don't remember making a conscious decision to go down that path in my life, but that's what I started to do. Whatever I thought you thought was cool, I would do it. And I think it's important to mention, I can remember this clearly. It was at the beginning of my, I believe it was 7th or 8th grade. It was before school. It was like the first week of school. It was before the home period bell had rung. And there was a group of us, 5 or 6 of us boys, standing in between the lockers talking. And I remember standing there talking with my buddies, thinking, all of a sudden I got this thought, man, how am I standing right now? Do I got one hand in my pocket? I got another hand out. Is how I'm standing cool? Is it okay? Is what I'm saying make sense to them? How do I look right now to my friends? And how do I look? How do I sound? What do you think of me? How do I look? How do I sound? What do you think of me? Is what I'm wearing okay? Is how I'm speaking okay? How do I look? How do I sound? What do you think of me? Started spinning in my head. And I can tell you that dominated me for the next 30 years. I mean, I've had taste of that just right now. You know, I'm wearing a blue suit and I wear tennis shoes with a suit. What do they think of me? I'm not from here. You know, I got short hair. Maybe I should have long hair. Should I grow a mustache? Do I look okay? Do I not look okay? Do I sound okay? Are they going to like me? That happens for me. And if I don't recognize it and shut it down, what happens is I'm gone from being in this present moment. I can't be in relationship with you. And I would learn later here in Alcoholics Anonymous that that's based in self-centered fear. I'm selfish. I like to think about me. So that was going into junior high, and a couple years later was after, well, not a couple years later, a year later, after 8th grade, my dad promoted in the federal government, and we moved to Southern California, and by then I had really anchored in to being pissed off at him and blaming him for the things that were wrong in my life and the choices that I was making and the way that I was feeling. And so when we moved to a little small town just inland from Ventura called Ojai. And there's a lot of money in that town, and my family's not a lot of money. And I was mad. I was so mad. I'd lived in the same house my whole life on the same street, had the same group of friends, and I was just pissed. How could you do this? And it just started to bubble in me and to boil over. And I started to do little violent stuff. You know, I'd break something or put my hand through a wall. And but what I had in my toolbox was I was a really good class clown. And I was a great chameleon. So I found that when I went to this new school, I tried the jock angle, and it didn't really work out for me. I ran cross country, and there's not like super studs in cross country. So that kind of worked against me. And then I tried out for the soccer team, and where I had been one of the best players where I grew up, I came to this town, and I didn't even make the team. I got cut. And I was devastated. And that was my dad's fault, too. And that was the school's fault. And that was the coach's fault. And these rich kids' fault. It couldn't have been that I hadn't been practicing and playing club like they had been. So I just fostered these resentments and fostered these resentments and got angrier and angrier, but was continually getting these quick burns at school. And so my freshman year started out with, making noises and popping wisecracks in the back of the class and getting a detention or a referral. The next semester, it was smoking cigarettes out in the parking lot. And then that summer, going into my sophomore year of high school, I had a great high schooler job. I was working as a prep cook and a dishwasher in the basement of a convalescent home. It was like, I look back on it now and I'm thinking, dude, you cannot get more punk rock than that. That was awesome. But I hated that place. And the cook that I worked with asked me one day, he said, do you smoke weed? And I was like, yeah, I do smoke weed. And I had never smoked weed. And I heard a speaker say this one time when he was sharing his pitch, and I identify with it. He said, when someone asked me, hey, do you want to smoke a joint? What I heard was, hey, you want to hang out with us? You want to be with us? And that's what I heard. I heard that from this guy, this older guy. Hey, do you smoke weed? Yeah, I do. And so the next day we smoked a little pot. And I remember I felt a little bit of at ease. I felt a little bit of ease. That constant chatter that I had going on in my head of, what do you think of me? Am I okay? What's going on with my dad? What do my friends think? Why don't I fit in here? It kind of quelled it a little bit. It didn't shut it out entirely, but it kind of numbed it down. And I remember thinking, man, that's nice. And a couple months later, you know, I did that on and off throughout the summer. And then a couple months later, school started. And a couple of older classmen asked me if I wanted to go out with them on a Friday night. And that was when I had my first drink. And I don't have a cool Jack Daniels, Jim Beam, moonshine, first tough guy drink. But I don't even have a Budweiser first drink tough guy story. What I had was, those guys pulled up and I had four citrus wine coolers. And I remember riding around in the back of this lousy hatchback smoking Marlboro Reds. And I had drank those four wine coolers, and I felt a sense of ease and comfort. I was better looking. I could talk. I was comfortable with these guys, and that constant chatter that I didn't even know was actually happening, that constant restless, irritable, and discontented feeling that I had stopped. And I felt a sense of peace. And we rode around in that car all night and talked to girls, and man, it was wonderful. And I didn't say it out loud. I don't remember making having a solemn oath or anything, but what I did do is I made a behavioral commitment to do that as often and as much as I possibly could. I was going to be right there as often and as much as I possibly could. And so that's what I did throughout high school. I drank, and I didn't limit it to drinking or smoking pot. It was whatever. Whatever you have. If it's up, if it's down, if it's all around, it didn't matter to me. I was game. And so my alcoholism kicked in. that thing that we talk about, that how we're bodily and mentally different. In that moment, when I felt that sense of ease, it switched for me. And I was in. I thought I found a solution. I found a solution that would work. And so, excuse me, over the next 3 or 4 years, that's what I did. As much alcohol, I drank as much, and I used as much drugs as I could get my hands on. And as that increased, it would be apparent that my school time decreased and my criminal activity increased. So I started to drink and use more drugs. I went to school less, and I committed more crime. I think a year after I started drinking, I went to rehab for the first time. I ended up in a community psychiatric ward down in Ventura County, and I spent 30 days there, and they did it outpatient, and I thought I was brilliant. I was going to run from the outpatient, and then I called my dad, and he took me right back. And a year later, I went to another juvenile treatment center when I was 17 and smoked weed in the bathroom of the program. And the following year, I put myself in an adult treatment facility, and I think I made it 72 days. And in all those instances, I was introduced to the 12 steps. I had rides to meetings, but the only thing that I would do is I would go to meetings, I would bum cigarettes, and I would drink coffee. And that was my routine. And I never worked a step, and I never got a sponsor. And when I did read the book, I read the stories in the back, and I looked at those people as heroes, the first parts of their stories. This is what I want to live up to. And I remember when I was 16, I read the story in the third edition, A Five-Time Loser Wins, and about this guy, he goes to prison for 5 different times. And I just omitted the part of his sobriety and when he was in the solution, and I was like, dude, that's the guy right there, man. He's cool. He broke his foot with a sledgehammer to get out of work. That's what I want to be like that. Poured lye on himself so he could get some drugs. I like that. So that was where my mind was. So I somehow ended up graduating high school, continuation school, and the last time I got out of a program, my counselor told me, he said, if you do not do this, you are going to end up dead or in jail in a year. And I laughed at him with my whopping 30 days, and I took my 30-day chip, and I told him, I'll be back in a year to shove my year chip. And I made it maybe 70 days, and I was back out, ripping and running. And so how I did it was, throughout high school and after, into my early 20s, I would start drinking and using in Southern California, and I would leave and go live in Northern California. And I would do that until the wheels fell off up there, and then I would head back down south. And I'd sober up for a bit and do that a bit down there, and so I was just geographicking back and forth. And committing more crime. And so when I got out of high school, that's when it really kicked in for me. What started out as you know, breaking and stealing a bike, then turned into breaking into garages. And then from breaking into garages to stealing cars. And then starting to sell drugs. And then burglarizing homes. And I was on another trip back up to Northern California because things weren't working out for me in Southern California. And it must be my family in Southern California. It must be the Ventura County Sheriff's Department. It must be the DAs. It must be these people that are the problem. It couldn't be me. And so I find myself back in Northern California in 1996. I was there for a week and got a DUI. 2 months later, I broke my leg drunk. And 2 months later after that, a friend and I went to a bar and we decided that we would commit a robbery. And we were gonna fake a drug deal with this guy, and what happened was we committed a robbery and we committed a homicide. And 6 days later, I was arrested. Both of us were. And I spent the next 21 years in prison. The direct result of my alcoholism, of my thinking, of my victim mentality and blaming others, I allowed myself to justify why I could act out and take what I wanted from others and commit the ultimate act of violence. And it still wasn't my fault. It was other people's fault. It was shamefully this man who asked me to storm drugs, his fault. It's the DA's office. Why are they treating me like this? And so I spent a few years in the county jail, and I thought that I had things together. I started going to church, I started reading the Bible, and I got super involved in the Christian faith. And I'm not dogging that out. If that's your belief, man, that's awesome. But what I've refused to do is I refused to examine myself. I refused to take responsibility for who I was. I refused to look at causes and conditions in my life. And so in 1998, I left the county jail and I went to state prison. And it was just a few years later, 2001, I was sitting on a prison yard right here. It's funny that I'm a visitor to the Central Valley, because I've spent a good portion of my life in the Central Valley. So I was sitting at a spot out in West Fresno County, and a friend of mine asked me, "Hey, I have some Nerve pills. You want them?" And I said, "Yep, I do." And so in the summer of 2001, I started taking drugs again, and a couple months later, I started drinking homemade wine. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't really like pills, and I don't really like speed. Alcohol is good, but it's a pain in the butt in prison. And so what is available in prison is heroin. And so I just dove in. And I'm a good, you know, I could be hip, slick, and cool, and I'm a manipulator. And so it wasn't long before I had the bag and we were bringing it in. And when you have the bag and you're bringing it in, you're telling people what to do. And we like to say that, no, that's not how it goes. But that's exactly how it goes. That's exactly how it goes. And so that's what I did. That's what I did for the next 6 years in prison. Cover myself in tattoos, and was involved in the gang lifestyle in prison, and trafficking drugs, and participating in violence. It was the perfect place for someone who was trying to get to fill a hole in their heart with other people's acceptance. It was just like high school for me, add violence. So, I better hustle up. So it was in 2006. In 2005, I sat on a prison yard with a friend of mine who I knew had been sober for a number of years. I was talking to him, and I said, "Man, I think I want to quit." He just told me, he said, "Listen, man." He goes, "Why don't you shut the fuck up?" He goes, "You're not..." He goes, "If you want to talk about sports, if you want to talk about music, you want to talk about skateboarding, awesome." He goes, "But dude, you're not done. And don't come crying and pissing and moaning to me about how you want to quit." And I can tell you today that that hard-ass, hard-nosed AA saved my life. And I'm grateful for it. And so I continued to do some research for the next year. And you would think, one would think that a life sentence, a 25 to life sentence in prison, and the consequences and all that goes with why I was there would be enough. But I am not a consequential thinker. I'm a magical thinker. I'm going to continue to do the same stuff, worse, and it'll magically be okay. That's how my brain works, left unchecked. So it was a year later that I remember sitting in my prison cell, and I was supposed to be the guy, and yet I was a coward and I was scared. I really just wanted to go home, and I wasn't going home, and I was probably going to die in this shithole. And I remember thinking, man, I'm a fraud, man. I'm not who I've been pretending to be. And I owe this guy who owes that guy, and dudes don't even know what kind of a low life I really am. And something happened. I had a moment of clarity. And I went back to my friend Charlie, who was my first sponsor, and I asked him. I told him I'm done. I need help. And he just looked at me and I said, "Will you sponsor me?" And he goes, "I'll help you. I'll help you work the steps." And that was September 1st, 2006. And I relapsed on the 21st. And I thought that if I didn't tell anyone in 6 months, it wouldn't make a big deal. Who cares? I'm not going to be the only one that knows. And then 8 days later, my cellmate asked me, he said, "Hey, dude, you're coming up on 30 days. And I was like, "Oh." And I couldn't sleep all night. And so I learned a lesson in honesty early in recovery, that I gotta be honest with me. Yes, I need to be honest with you guys, but I gotta live here. I gotta live in my skin. And so it was also around that same time that my family found my. I got a job at one of those like in treatment programs in prison. They were looking for lifers to be like role models, and I was like, "I'll do it." I had like 45 days sober, and I was telling my little sister on the phone, and she said, "Man, that's awesome. How much time do you got sober?" Like the 10 years that you've been in there. And I was like, yeah. So what's mom doing right now? And I had this huge fear that if I told my family the truth, that they would be done. And I learned another lesson about God's grace right there. I called my mom, who's a staunch member of Al-Anon, and she let me have it. She said, "Man, I feel like you kicked me in the stomach." And I was like, "Well, what do you think, Dad?" And she's like, "I don't know what he's going to have to say about this." And so I just ripped the Band-Aid off and I called him. And that dude shocked me. I told him, "Man, I got to talk to you for a minute." And he goes, "What's going on?" I go, "Man, I messed up a few years ago, and I've been drinking and using for the last few years, and I haven't been able to stop. And I got a couple month and a half or so now, and I'm afraid if I don't tell you, I won't stay sober." And he just was quiet, and he said, "Well, are you done?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm done." And he goes, "Well, I love you. You're my son. And how can I help you?" Like, I could share that with you now. My dad's been gone almost 10 years. That's God. That's God at work. And so I threw myself into the 12 steps. We had three meetings a week were on the yard that I was on, and so I went to all three of them, and then I worked at that recovery place, and I worked the steps as best I could with my sponsor, and I did what he told me to do, and I prayed when he told me to pray, and I wrote when he told me to write. I followed direction because I was willing. I was desperate. Like, dude, this is not working for me. And I didn't necessarily want to get away from like the other stuff that I was doing. I just really wanted to sober up. And so I had about 18 months sober, and I ordered a hit on somebody. And I remember thinking after that happened that, dude, you're doing the same thing you've always done. You just don't have drugs or alcohol to numb it out. And that guy's okay. He's not hurt or he didn't die or anything like that. He's okay now. God used that, and I had another moment of clarity that I was going to have to abandon my way of thinking. And it was hard. It was challenging. I didn't leave where I was. I stayed at the facility that I was at, and I spent the next year. We went on a long lockdown. I spent the next year in a cell, and then I got to transfer to, my points dropped, and I transferred to a place over on the coast, Soledad, and there was an amazing, amazing recovery program there. There was like 5-6 meetings a week. All these H&I people were bringing stuff in, bringing books and bringing meetings, and I was like, dude, I can't get enough of this. Let me go. I'm going. And so it was Monday and Tuesday and double dip on Wednesday and Saturday mornings, and there was these guys that came in, and my friend Karen knows these guys, and they were idiots. They would just talk about the big book all the time, and it was super offensive, right? They're quoting lines and page numbers, and you're like, dude, shut up with all that hard stuff. But those guys had something. They were on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. And they shared with us that they were traveling around the country, starting little conferences, getting ready for the road to Detroit this next summer. And I asked them, I'm all, dude, that's amazing. They would come back every month and they would tell us about this. And so I asked them, do you think we could do a conference in prison? And they're like, man, we don't know. We never heard about that. We never even heard of that. And they're like, well, we're going to go back. We're going to talk to our sponsor, and we'll get back to you next month. And so I was having a hard time waiting for a month to go by. So I just went to our staff liaison, and she was like, look, here's the paperwork. If you write out a proposal, I'll sign off on it. And so they came back, and they're like, our sponsor doesn't know. We're going to talk to the grand sponsor. And I'm like, dude, we're going to get approved. So so in January of 2016, we got to have the first ever 3-day Alcoholics Anonymous conference in a state prison. Because these guys were bringing the message in, and we were starting to catch fire. And it wasn't that they weren't bringing in a meeting. They were coming in and attending the meeting that we were holding. It was awesome. And so from that conference started two workshops, one in the spring and one in the fall. And then a book study started on Sunday nights. And we would have, Josh knows, we'd have 120 guys in a circle in the gym. And I should say, I've been a little resistant to go to men's stag meetings because I went to 20 years of them straight without a break. So, grace me out on that. So anyhow, I continue to work the steps. I continue to have commitments. And what I learned is that I don't say no. When someone asks for help, I say yes. When I get asked to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, at my ability, I say yes. And as a direct result of working the 12 steps, I began to get down to causes and conditions of why I am the way that I am and why I think the way that I am. And so in August of 2017, I went to the parole board, and I was able to talk with them honestly and openly and take responsibility for my life. And they made a decision that I was suitable for parole. And I got to come home. 4 months later, I got to come home. And I can tell you this, I came home on December 7th. And that day, December 7th at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I was at a meeting. And the next morning at 6 a.m., I was in a meeting. And when someone asked me to do something, I said yes. And I haven't had a need to go anywhere else. Because you guys have caught me. So I believe this book. I believe it. I believe in what it says. I believe in the doctor's opinion. I believe in Bill's story when he shares with us. I believe that when we talk about more about alcoholism, there is a solution. We agnostics, how it works, into action, working with others. This is the nuts and bolts of how we get to stay here. And the cool thing is that, you know, this is the same book that I had when I was in prison. The 164 pages are exactly the same pages out here as they are in there. There's no difference. And if you apply them to your life, you can be free. That's been my experience. I got to get free in prison before I came free out here. And I know that that's true because I'm living in that. Today I have an amazing life today. I have a restored relationship with my mom. I have a great relationship with my little sister and her family. You know, I have a home group, the 7 a.m. Keep It Simple in Ventura, that is there 7 days a week. I have a sobriety date of September 22nd in 2006, and I have a sponsor, Dan G., who I love, who's rebuilding me. And all this I got here from you guys, it's free. Who the fuck would have ever thought? It's free. So, you know, if you're new, you don't have to go anywhere else. You're welcome here. No matter where you're from, no matter what your background is, no matter, you know, no matter. You could have this. And it's not necessarily going to be better, but it'll be different. It will be different. And you can have a new life. You could have a new life. And you could have a free life. And you could experience God's grace. And you could live in hope here. That's been my experience. And so I know that I went over time. And I don't apologize. But I want to thank you, Bill, for asking me to share. And I want to thank you. And if you're new, man, get a commitment in the meeting. And help someone else. Don't say no, say yes. Thank you for letting me share.